بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله وسلم على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. اللهم صل على سيدنا محمد الفاتح لما أغلق وخاتم لما سبق، ناصر الحق بالحق، والهادي إلى صراطك المستقيم، وعلى آله حق قدره ومقداره العظيم. اللهم لا علم لنا إلا ما علمتنا إنك أنت العليم الحكيم. اللهم علمنا ما ينفعنا وانفعنا بما تعلمنا وزدنا من فضلك علما وتعليما إنك على كل شيء قدير. الحمد لله وشكر لله. So we have to realize, as we mentioned, or to recapitulate a little bit of what we said before, we have to realize that of all the things that one, of all of the good things that one may seek, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is incomparably supreme. Whoever finds Allah, Ya Ilahi, ماذا فقد من وجدك ومن الذي وجد من فقدك. My dear Lord, what has he missed out on who finds you? And what has he found who lacks you? And so sometimes things pull us aside in the spiritual path. We're telling stories tonight. It's not him. But however, there are some things that are the under the shaitan wa silahu, the gear of the shaitan and his weaponry. Wa nas'alullah tawfiq wa taysir. The best kind of food is the kind that you don't have to think about until you're ready to eat it. This is my philosophy. So we're reading a few things in order to not be pulled aside. We're talking about fitness in general, and these are some of the things that make people make it impossible to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, being ill. And being ill is a consequence of, in our times of affluence, we were always told to finish our plate. My mother would say, think of the starving people in India. And so we would finish off our plate and hope that it would do something for the starving people. Nowadays, in places, or in Africa, and so forth. Nowadays, in Africa, there are two obese people for every person that is starving. So the things have changed in the world, but people are still suffering. This is an article from The Guardian. I have a number of unconnected, loosely connected. We'll try to connect them in the end. Article from The Guardian. We'll start with stories. By Jacques Peretti. And June 11th of the earlier this month. Question. Who is responsible for making us fat? He talks about various fat people. One person got stuck in the hallway. He was unable to go in forward or backward until the firemen rescued him. And it sounds like a bad joke. So I'll skip the author has to create a desire for people to read the rest of his article. We'll skip that. I don't have a desire. Muslim. I know, as Hashimi said in the Bay'ah, he said, and from the Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, it comes, it's sahih from some of the Sahaba that they said, Bay'ah Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam ala nasihi li kulli Muslim. To do well means to do well by, right, to benefit every Muslim, right, to the limit. And so the Bay'ah in this tariqah is upon this point also. And I, the force of the evidence and my understanding is that it would be impossible to mean well to every Muslim without talking about some of these topics. And so, it's paragraph number 4, we go directly to it. He says, on the average in the UK, we are all, every man, woman, and child, 3 stone heavier than we were in the mid-1960s. North America, stone just reminds people of the Stone Age. I had to look it up. It means a stone is 14 pounds, according to the dictionary that I looked at. So he goes, and he said, we haven't noticed it happening, but this glacial shift has been mapped by bigger car seats, swimming cubicles, XL trousers dropped to L, L dropped to M, an elasticated nation with an ever-expanding sense of normality. Why are we so fat? We have not become greedier as a race. We are not, contrary to popular wisdom, less active. A 12-year study which began in 2000 at Plymouth Hospital measured children's physical activity and found it the same as 50 years ago. I don't believe it. But something has changed, and that something is very simple. It's the food we eat. More specifically, the sheer amount of sugar in that food. Sugar we're often unaware of. The story begins in 1971. Richard Nixon was facing re-election. The Vietnam War was threatening his popularity at home. But just as big an issue with voters was the soaring cost of food. If Nixon was to survive, he needed food prices to go down. And that required getting a very powerful lobby on board, the farmers. Nixon appointed Earl Butz, an academic from the farming heartland of Indiana, to broker a compromise. Butz, an agricultural expert, had a radical plan that would transform the food we eat, and in doing so, the shape of the human race. Butz pushed farmers into a new industrial scale of production, into farming one crop in particular, corn. U.S. cattle were fattened by the immense increases in corn production. Burgers became bigger. Fries fried in corn oil became fattier. Corn became the engine for a massive surge in the quantities of cheaper food being supplied to American supermarkets. Everything from cereals to biscuits and flour found new uses for corn. Unfortunately, the corn disappeared. The corn that we have in Jordan is the last apparent remnant that I've been able to find anywhere of savory corn. Real corn, what does it taste like? It tastes like corn chips. It's a savory food. And it's still found here. Monsanto hasn't displaced it with their hybrid seeds yet. But in any other country, you can't find anything left of it. What you get when you bite into a piece of corn, it tastes like a popsicle. It's really sugary, so they can make ethanol out of it, what? Alcohol out of it, and other things, and corn syrup, sugar. It's disappeared. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keep it in existence here. It's good food. As a result of Butz's free market reforms, American farmers almost overnight went from parochial smallholders to multimillionaire businessmen with a global market. One Indiana farmer believes that America could have won the Cold War by simply starving the Russians of corn, but instead they chose to make money. By the mid-70s, there was a surplus of corn. Butz flew to Japan to look into scientific innovation that would change everything. The mass development of high fructose corn syrup, or glucose fructose syrup, as it's often referred to in the UK, a highly sweet, gloppy syrup produced from surplus corn that was also incredibly cheap. He calls it HFCS before, despite the, okay, high fructose corn syrup, I'll call it corn syrup, had been discovered in the 50s, but it was only in the 70s that a process had been found to harness it for mass production. Corn syrup was soon pumped into every conceivable food, pizzas, coleslaw, meat. It provided that just baked sheen on bread and cakes, made everything sweeter, and extended shelf life from days to years. A silent revolution of the amount of sugar that was going into our bodies was taking place. In Britain, the food on our plates became pure science, each processed milligrams tweaked and sweetened for maximum palatability. And the general public were clueless that these changes were taking place. But there was one product in particular that had a dramatic effect on soft drinks. Hank Cardello, the former head of marketing at Coca-Cola, tells me that in 1984, Coke in the U.S. switched from sugar to corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup. In the UK, it continued to use sugar. As a market leader, Coke's decision sent a message of endorsement to the rest of the industry, which quickly followed suit. There was, quote, no downside to high fructose corn syrup, Cordello says. It was two-thirds the price of sugar, and even the risk of messing with the taste was a risk worth taking when you looked at the margin, 50% more profit, especially as there was no apparent health risks. At that time, quote, obesity wasn't even on the radar, says Cordello. But another health issue was on the radar, heart disease. And in the mid-70s, a fierce debate was raging behind the closed doors of academia over what was causing it. An American nutritionist called Ansel Keys blamed fat, while a British researcher at the University of London, Professor John Yudkin, blamed sugar. But Yudkin's work was rubbished by what many believe, including Professor Robert Lustig, one of the world's leading endocrinologists. Endocrinologist looks at the hormonal control of the body's levels of various substances. In this case, particularly, what comes to mind is insulin production, what the pancreas puts out to manage all of this sugar. And so but Ludkin's work was trashed by what many believe, including Professor Robert Lustig, one of the world's leading endocrinologists, was a concerted campaign to discredit Yudkin. Much of the criticism came from fellow academics whose research was aligning far more closely with the direction the food industry was intending to take. Yudkin's colleague at that time, Dr. Richard Bruckdorfer at UCLA, says there was a huge lobby from the industry, i.e. food industry, particularly from the sugar industry. And Yudkin complained bitterly that they were subverting some of his ideas. Yudkin was, Lustig says simply, thrown under the bus because there was a huge financial gain to be made by fingering fat, not sugar, as the culprit of heart disease. The food industry had its eyes on the creation of a new genre of food, something they knew the public would embrace with huge enthusiasm, believing it to be better for their health. Quote, low fat. It promised an immense business opportunity forged from the potential disaster of heart disease. But, says Lustig, there was a problem. When you take the fat out of a recipe, food tastes like cardboard, and you need to replace it with something, that something being sugar. Overnight, new products arrived on the shelves that seemed too good to be true. Low-fat yogurts, spreads, even desserts and biscuits, all with the fat taken out and replaced with sugar. Britain was one of the most enthusiastic adopters of what food writer Gary Taubes, author of Why We Get Fat, calls the, quote, low-fat dogma, with sales rocketing. By the mid-1980s, health experts such as Professor Philip James, a world-renowned British scientist who was one of the first to identify obesity as an issue, noticed that people were getting fatter and no one could explain why. The food industry was keen to point out that individuals must be responsible for their own calorie consumption, but even those who exercised and ate low-fat products were gaining weight. In 1966, the proportion of people with a BMI over 30 classified as obese, and the BMI is hokey, but the measuring the waist is not, I can say. The proportion of people classified as obese was just 1.2% for men and 1.8% for women in 1966. By 1989, the figures had risen to 10.6% of men and 14% for women. And no one was joining the dots between high fructose corn syrup and fat. Moreover, there was something else going on. The more sugar we ate, the more we wanted, and the hungrier we became. At New York University, Professor Anthony Sclafani, a nutritionist studying appetite and weight gain, noticed something strange about his lab rats. When they ate rat food, they put on weight normally, but when they ate processed food from a supermarket, they ballooned in a matter of days. Their appetite for sugary foods was insatiable. They just carried on eating. According to Professor Jean-Marc Schwartz of San Francisco Hospital, who is currently studying the precise way in which the major organs of the body metabolize sugar, this momentum creates a tsunami of sugar. The effect this has on different organs of the body is only now being understood by scientists. The articles we'll subsequently read here, inshallah. Around the liver, it coalesces as fat. leading to diseases such as type 2 diabetes. We talked about visceral fat before, fat inside the gut. It's much more threatening than others. Other studies have found that sugar may even coat semen and result in obese men becoming less fertile. One researcher told me that ultimately perhaps nothing needs to be done about obesity, as obese people will wipe themselves out. The organ of the most interest, however, is the gut. According to Schwartz and Sclafani, the gut is a highly complex nervous system. It is the body's second brain. It has as many nerve cells as the brain and spinal column have, and it functions independently. The majority of these are completely independent of the brain's control. It controls itself, and so it is what Wright called a second brain. And this, when the second brain becomes conditioned to wanting more sugar, sending messages back to the brain that are impossible to fight. The Sugar Association is keen to point out that sugar intake alone, quote, is not linked to any lifestyle disease, but the evidence to the contrary appears to be emerging. In February, Lustig, Laura Schmidt, and Clara Brandis of the University of California wrote an opinion article for the journal Nature, citing the growing body of scientific evidence showing that fructose can trigger processes that lead to liver toxicity and a host of other chronic diseases. Liver toxicity is not a mild thing. The liver has over 250 jobs that it does in the body. And if it kicks, you feel it. You're a thief. And a host of other chronic diseases, chronic meaning that don't go away, that stay and stay and stay. And in March, the New York Times reported a study that had been published in the journal Circulation, which found that men who drank sweetened beverages most often were 20% more likely to have a heart attack than those who drank the least. David Kessler, former head of the U.S. government's most powerful food agency, the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, and the person responsible for introducing warnings on cigarette packets in the early 90s, believes that sugar, with its metabolism by the gut and hence the brain, is extremely addictive, just like cigarettes or alcohol. He believes that sugar is hedonic. Eating it is, quote, highly pleasurable. It gives you this momentary bliss. When you're eating food that is highly hedonic, it sort of takes over your brain. In London, Dr. Tony Goldstone is mapping out specific parts of the brain that are stimulated by this process. According to Goldstone, one of the byproducts of obesity is that a hormone called leptin ceases to work properly. Normally, leptin is produced by the body to tell you that you are full. However, in obese people, it becomes severely depleted, and it is thought that a high intake of sugar is a key reason. When leptin doesn't work, your body simply doesn't realize you should stop eating. Leptin raises a big question. Did the food industry knowingly create foods that were addictive, that would make you feel as though you were never satisfied and always wanted more? Kessler is cautious in his response. He doesn't want to get sued. Did they understand the neuroscience? No. But they learned experientially what worked, what sold. This is highly controversial. If it could be proved that at some point the food industry became aware of the long-term detrimental effects of their products were having on the public, and continued to develop and sell them, the scandal would rival that of what happened to the tobacco industry. Also the lawsuits by class action. The food industry's defense has always been that science doesn't prove its culpability, that it's guilty. Susan Neely, president of the American Beverage Association, a lobby for the soft drinks industry, says, there's a lot of work to try to establish causality, and I don't know that I've seen any study that does that. But it looks as though things might be changing. According to Professor Kelly Brownell at Yale University, one of the foremost experts on obesity and its causes, the science will soon be irrefutable, and we may just be a few hours away from the first successful lawsuit. The relationship between the food industry and scientists conducting research into obesity is also complicated by the issue of funding. There's not a great deal of money set aside for this work, and so the food industry becomes a vital source of income. By this means, the very same science going into combating obesity could also be used to hone the products that are making us obese. Many of the scientists I spoke to are worried about going on the record because they fear their funding will be taken away if they speak out. Cowardice. The relationship between government and the food industry is also far from straightforward. Health Secretary Andrew Lansley worked until 1909 as the non-executive director of Profuro, a marketing agency whose clients have included Pizza Hut, Mars, and PepsiCo. In opposition, Lansley asked public health expert Professor Simon Capewell to contribute to future policy on obesity. Capewell was amazed at the degree to which the food industry was also being consulted, the equivalent, he says, of putting Dracula in charge of the blood bank. Lansley has made no secret of his work for Profaro and denies a conflict of interest, saying that he did not work directly with the company's clients. And the government argues, not unreasonably, that it's essential to have the industry on board to get anything done. But relationships are not always kept at arm's length. Professor James was part of a World Health Organization committee to recommend global limits on sugar in 1990. As the report was being drafted, something extraordinary happened. The U.S. Secretary of State for Health, Tommy Thompson, flew to Geneva to lobby on behalf of the sugar industry. Those recommendations were never made, says James. In New York, Mayor Bloomberg is currently planning to reduce soft drink supersizing. Well, last week, a former executive at Coca-Cola, Todd Puttman, spoke publicly about the need for soft drink companies to move their focus to healthy products. Fat chance. But it is not going to be easy to bring about change. A previous attempt to bring a soda tax was stopped by intense lobbying on Capitol Hill. The soft drinks industry paid for a new ward at Philadelphia Children's Hospital, and the tax went away. It was a children's obesity ward. Why has Kessler, when he has had such success with his warnings on cigarette packets, not done the same thing for processed foods high in sugar? Because, he tells me, when the warnings came on cigarettes, the game was already up in the West for the tobacco industry. Their new markets were the Far East, India and China. It was no concession at all. The food industry is a different matter. For one thing, the food lobby is more powerful than the tobacco lobby. The industry is tied into a complex matrix of other interests, drugs, chemicals, and even dieting products. The panoply of satellite industries making money from obesity means that the food industry's relationship to obesity is an incredibly complex one. And Milton, the Minister for Public Health, tells me that legislation against the food industry isn't being ruled out because of the escalating cost to the National Health Service from obesity. Previous governments have always taken the route of partnership. Why? Because the food industry provides hundreds and thousands of jobs and billions in revenue. It is immensely powerful, and any politician who takes it on does so at their peril. Let's get one thing straight, Milton tells me, however. I am not scared of the food industry. And I believe her, because now there is something far bigger to be frightened of. Eventually, the point will be reached when the cost to the National Health Service of obesity, which is now £5 billion a year, outweighs the revenue from U.S. snacks and the confectionery market, which currently is approximately £8 billion per year. The solution to obesity will become very simple. And that's the end of this. So that's a historical sketch to describe what's going on. And so we have an article here. And this one first, I think, would be better. Food addiction. And so from this magazine that I mentioned earlier, Nutrition Action. How are we doing for time? We have a little time to read these articles. So it's food addiction. Picture three random American adults in a room. The odds are one is obese, one is overweight, and one is normal weight. If the three were children, one would be overweight or obese. And obesity rates in children are still rising. Clearly, there is no single cause of the obesity epidemic. Our 24 exposure to calorie-dense food and long hours at a desk or dashboard play a role. But new evidence suggests that some foods may keep us eating by hijacking the brain like an addictive drug. Kelly Brownell, previously quoted, says, "How much overeating in the population is attributable to these foods working on the brain so people keep coming back for more?" asks Kelly Brownell, professor of psychology at Yale University. It's possible that once people start consuming these foods, the brain changes in ways that make it very difficult to stop. Here's what we're learning about food addiction. The food industry obviously manipulates the qualities of its foods to maximize desirability, says Kelly Brownell, who directs the Yale University's Red Center for Food Policy and Obesity. That's what they're in business to do. But if some foods start taking over the brain to create a biological demand, that's a problem, he adds. Both animal and human studies suggest that an addictive process is profoundly possible. Here's the evidence that some foods may alter the brain like an addictive drug. What is food addiction? There is no clinically recognized definition. Basically, addiction in general can be to a number of things. It's anything that stimulates dopamine and beta endorphins that stimulate the pleasure centers in the brain. Whether it be heroin, whether it be cocaine, whether it be high fructose corn syrup, whether it be pornography, also all of these things. They take Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created a reinforcement in the brain for things that give satisfaction and so that we can do them. For example, the food doesn't satisfy you, but rather Allah creates satisfaction for the food by means of reward, chemical rewarding chemicals that make you feel satisfied after you've eaten. Otherwise, you wouldn't desire the food that is a needed fuel. You wouldn't, you know, go for it to refuel yourself. It wouldn't happen in our species or another species. I can't remember the name, the meta reward system in the brain. And addiction is defined physiologically. We read a paper about this question in the, at the American Sohba about 3 years ago about addictions and pornography addiction in general. It's when something that is of not has no survival value to the human being and no is hijacked by these processes, whether it be cocaine or whether it be methamphetamine or whether it be heroin or whether it be pornography or whether it be sadism or whether it be, you know, so people become perverted and the things that Allah has created in the brain in order to make us return to things that are beneficial to our well-being become hijacked by other things that stimulate their production. This is the meaning of addiction in general. And the brain changes in its structure, always. The brain aligns itself. Just like the muscles, people look as different inwardly as they look outwardly. And the muscles realign themselves if you exercise, and the brain realigns itself when you use it for things, whether for good or for bad. He says, what is food addiction? There's no clinically recognized definition, says Marcia Pelchett of the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. In other words, you won't find food addiction in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, that is used by mental health professionals. However, the DSM does have a definition of substance dependence, notes Pelchak. Dependence is a clinical term for addiction. There are 7 criteria, and you have to meet 3 of them within a year. In 2009, Brownell and his colleague Ashley Gearhart adapted those criteria to food. We wanted to see if traditional criteria for substance abuse could be applied to eating and obesity arena, says Brownell, and it's pretty clear that the answer is yes. In a survey of roughly 350 Yale undergraduates, 11% of respondents met the criteria for food dependence. In particular, many reported a loss of control when eating, a persistent desire to or effort to cut back, and heavy use despite deleterious consequences. Once the Yale food addiction scale starts getting administered to large populations, we'll know more about how common addictive eating is, its relationship to obesity and its health consequences, says Brownell. However, relatively few people fall into that category, he notes. And though these people need help, they're not his main worry. We're not as concerned about the extreme cases, but the everyday cases of people eating an unhealthy diet. I'm less interested in the person who sits down and eats 15 donuts than the person who gets up in the morning and needs a sugared beverage to get the day going. The bigger question, can you make a case that the brain is being hijacked enough by certain foods that you've got a public health crisis, is this question. To find answers, some scientists have zeroed in on how the brain's response to some foods can parallel its response to drugs. Subtitle, dopamine. In 2001, Nora Volkow and her colleagues at the Brookhaven National Laboratory published a groundbreaking study called Brain Dopamine and Obesity. The results were stunning. Very obese people had lower levels of dopamine, lower levels of the happiness-producing chemical that Allah has created to get us back to activities that are satisfying and that help our well-being. And very obese people had lower levels of dopamine in the reward areas of their brains than did people who were normal weight. These brain scans were game changers, says Pamela Peake, assistant clinical professor of medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, because this is precisely the same thing that happens in meth heads, cocaine addicts, alcoholics, and other addicts. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that motivates us to eat and engage in sex and other, quote, rewarding behaviors. It reflects wanting more than liking. Animals that lack dopamine starve to death because they have no motivation to eat. This is the mechanism that nature created to enable you as an individual and species to survive, said Svolkov, now the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. If you ate a banana and it was delicious, the next time you were in the jungle and you saw it, you would have this drive to eat it. Drugs like cocaine, heroin, and morphine can hijack the system, and pornography also. Mesolimbic reward system is what it is called. That was in the article that was reread at the Sorbonne. Drugs like cocaine can hijack the system. By the randomness of nature, certain chemicals are able to activate the same circuits, explains Vokal, and they do it in a way that is much more potent than anything natural. Yet her brain scans are surprising. If dopamine makes you want to eat or take drugs, why should people who are obese or addicted to drugs have less of a dopamine response when they eat or take drugs? We used to believe that people were addicted because they were more sensitive to the rewarding effects, says Volkow. We thought that they had more dopamine release, that it would be more pleasurable. However, it's the opposite. Less reward makes them want more. It appears that people who don't get much reward from food or drugs want more and more because they never are satisfied, says Monell's Marcia Pelchat. Monell Chemical Senses Center is a scientific institute that does research on taste and smell. It's a chicken or egg question, which came first. Do some people overeat because they are born with a dopamine system that doesn't respond? Or do obese people have a low dopamine response because they overate and overstimulated their dopamine systems, asked Pelchat. There's some evidence for both. To sort things out, researchers are trying to look at dopamine responses before obesity sets in. Subtitle, Rats Fed Junk Food. Some studies see changes in dopamine release when rats are offered a so-called cafeteria diet. We gave animals access to foods that people might want to overeat, cookies, cheese, chocolate chips, marshmallows, and similar items, explains Nicole Avena, assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Florida College of Medicine. After a few months, the rats became obese and had lower dopamine levels than rats fed ordinary lab chow. Once they have this history of overeating this highly palatable junk food diet, their brains have changed, explained Avena. These changes are profound and long-lasting. And there is a happy ending to this, is that you can change the brain by using another area of brain that is under your own conscious control. What is it? It's the frontal lobes of the brain, the decision and prioritizing mechanism in the brain. So what does one have to do? Say no, very simply, and mean it. And this happens with alcoholics, and it happens with heroin addicts, and it has to happen with people who are addicted to the kind of stuff that they're talking about. I know. These changes were profound and long-lasting. Could obesity itself weaken the dopamine system? To find out, Swiss researchers made sure that rats fed ordinary chow got as many calories as fats read calorie-dense diet that was high in fat and sugar. Calorie-dense food is a milkshake, and the non-dense food is like a watermelon. And the amount of calories in it has a tremendous impact on making these foods most addictive. So the highest the person eats chocolate candy bars or something like that, that really have a lot of calories in them, is the one who becomes addicted the quickest, they will tell here. Both groups, and so they fed them each lab chow, ordinary, and calorie-dense diet that was high in fat and sugar, hamburgers and milkshakes. Both groups gained weight, but the group fed the calorie-dense diet had a reduction of dopamine receptors, while the other group did not. It changed their brains, explains Kyle Berger, a researcher at the Oregon Research Institute's Eating Disorders and Obesity Prevention Lab. So it's not necessarily weight gain, but the process of overeating calorie-dense food that changes dopamine receptors. And this is the last article. I don't know if I'll be able to read it tonight. It was this magazine taxes itself to come up with zippy titles. Don't be dense. And has a little picture here of the calorie dense fried chicken and French fries and milkshake or Coke or whatever it is on top. It's just a little bit of food. And this is all fruits and vegetables and other beverages. And it's a whole lot of food. And the good news is that the body, which your nafs gears itself to, is the volume and weight of food. So if you change your diet by having more whole foods, more fruits and vegetables, and a bowl of soup, for example, a vegetable stew or something, or some other kind of soup, before the meal, you get full, and you don't crave, you feel that like you've had a big meal. And so this is the good news. How you don't have to eat this calorie-dense stuff. You know, just save it for certain foods, for example. So we'll get to that later. Less response after weight gain. In a study of 26 young, overweight, and obese women, those who gained weight over 6 months had less response in areas of the brain targeted by dopamine when they drank a milkshake than they had had 6 months earlier. So the pleasure receptors, the capacity to enjoy the food diminishes. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller the more you shovel down the calorie-dense food. And this is the addiction, part of the addiction and obesity mechanism, the heart of the article, as it were. They also showed reduced dopamine response compared to the overweight women who remained weight-stable. A low dopamine response may be a double whammy for weight gainers. First, it may make them more likely to overeat. And overeating may dampen the dopamine response even more. So it's very dangerous thing. And it shows the picture that's too small for you to see. Brain scans of the dopamine receptors in a normal person, it's a big healthy area here, and the obese person, in which it is much shrunken. The normal person here, and the cocaine addict, in which it is much reduced. The normal person here, with a large red area, and the alcoholic, which is much reduced, that the structures are much the same. Subtitle, more response before weight gain. To study these people before they became obese, Berger's colleagues compared 30 teenagers who were at high risk for obesity, each had two overweight or obese parents, to 30 teens with low risk, all were at normal rate. Those at high risk for obesity had greater response to the dopamine target regions after drinking milkshakes than the low-risk teens. So obese people may start out not with an insensitive, but an oversensitive dopamine response. We think this initial vulnerability is the hook that gets you in, explains Berger. When you repeatedly consume the food because you're chasing the high, then you repeatedly consume the food because you're chasing the high. Berger and his colleagues are tracking the teens, so we'll know in a year or two. Researchers see another similarity between drug abuse and obesity. Obese adolescent girls show less response to dopamine target areas when drinking milkshakes than girls who are normal weight. However, the heavier girls show a greater response to pictures of the shakes, of these milkshakes. And the girls who respond most to food images are most likely to gain weight over the next year. Likewise, people who score higher in the Yale Food Addiction Scale show greater activity than others in the reward areas of the brain when they see pictures of a milkshake, but less activity when they drink it. So the desire is, it's the same pattern seen with drugs. In fact, that's what makes many people relapse after treatment for drug abuse. The moment an addictive individual sees a person they've taken the drug with or drug paraphernalia, dopamine release triggers an enormous desire to take the drug, says Volkow. And that's why they relapse. When it comes to food, the cues are everywhere. This hyper response to the cues and reduced response to the food implies that obese people may not have a compromised dopamine response to begin with, says Berger. Of course, milkshakes aren't cocaine. If someone were to take an illicit drug, it would release far more dopamine than Haagen-Dazs. And needless to say, rats aren't people. Rats are working off their impulses. Humans, and this is the point of reading this article, have highly developed cortexes so we can make decisions. There's no reason to dismiss rats. That's no reason to dismiss rat studies, she adds. They illustrate that we might need to exercise a lot of control over the way we think about food because of what our primitive brains are telling us to do. When it comes to drugs, changes in the dopamine system may cause changes in the cortex. In the obese, the fewer dopamine receptors are linked to less activity in the cortex. In other words, you have less willpower to change with. Repeated exposure to drugs disturbs a carefully calibrated balance in the frontal cortex, the decision and priority-making cortex, the nausea in the Quran, that is needed to exert control, make decisions, and exercise judgment. This area is the brain's brakes. And addicted people don't understand why they take the drug. It's like they're driving and they can't stop. They have no brakes. Which foods? Can any food be addictive? Sugar has been studied far more than anything else, says Brownell. Is fat a player? What about salt and all the preservatives and additives that go into food? Or the flavorings, or what the industry euphemistically calls flavor enhancers? What are those things doing in the brain? Nobody knows. But researchers have some clues. This is sugar. Working with the late Bart Hobel of Princeton University, Nicola Avina found that rats showed signs of dependence when exposed to sugar for only a few hours a day. When animals get sugar, they'll overeat, she explains, and they'll show tolerance to it. They eat more and more each day, perhaps to feel the same euphoria. If we take the sugar away, they show signs of withdrawal, anxiety, tremors, and shakes. And they'll show evidence of craving for the sugar. They're willing to work harder to get at sugar, and they'll show behaviors to suggest that they're seeking the sugar. Humans. Calorie-dense foods. In studies with people, Kyle Berger's research team started with milkshakes because they're not just sweet and fatty, but calorie-dense. They have lots of calories per swallow. It looks like habitual consumption of food, specifically calorie-dense food, can elicit changes in brain responses that mirror drug addiction, says Berger. Studies on craving also point to calorie-dense foods. We asked people, have you craved food in the last year? And we gave them a definition of craving, which is an intense desire to eat a particular food. Craving isn't addiction, she adds. The vast majority of people have cravings, and that wouldn't qualify as having an addiction. What do people crave? About 90% of the foods are calorie-dense and high in fat, says Pelchett. Fat is more calorie-dense than carbohydrates or protein. One guy told me he craved a Belgian endive, but he was thinking of it sautéed in cream sauce, etc. Among college students who are most often surveyed in eating studies, maybe 60% of what women write down are sweet foods, and they're usually also high in fat. Among men, 40% of the foods they crave are sweet. Allah. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Ashhadu an Muhammadan Rasulullah. Ashhadu an Muhammadan Rasulullah. Hayya 'ala salati, hayya 'ala salat. Hayya 'ala farah, hayya 'ala farah. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. La ilaha illallah. اللهم رب هذه الدعوة التامة والصلاة القائمة آتي سيدنا محمد وسيلته والفضيلة وبعثه مقاما محمودا الذي وعدته اللهم صل وسلم وبارك على سيدنا محمد So finally they say we can overcome the body's normal satiety signals that it's telling itself that it's full if we see food that we remember tastes very good. After dinner, no more dopamine will be triggered by seeing a piece of chicken, but it may be triggered by dessert, says Volkow. You see some chocolates and you want them. And it's not just one piece of chocolate. I can eat one piece and get satiated, but then I turn around and there's all these other varieties and they're novel and intriguing. Our theory is that if the body gets a normal food found in nature, most people won't overdo it. The body's satiety mechanisms will activate and behave in a reasonable way. But when you process the food so much that they become hyper-palatable, it thwarts the body's ability to regulate. Okay, what does refinement mean? We'll return to our previous group of lectures. Refinement is like if you have a sphere, it's the easiest way to think of it. When you have a sphere and you, a billiard ball, for example, or some solid sphere, and you break it in half, what happens to the surface area available on that thing? It increases. It almost, it probably increases by 50%. have the two inside faces now and all that you used to have. If you break it into four pieces, it increases and increases exponentially. If you grind it into powder, you've increased the surface area of that substance millions of times. And this is, in fact, what refinement is. It takes something and it grinds it into a fine powder, vastly, vastly, vastly increasing the surface area on which the metabolic processes of the body can work on it. And so what happens when you get something sweet? If you eat a handful of dates, you have a lump in your stomach, you know, that will release the sugar comparatively slowly. If you take a slice of cake with a lot of sugar in it, or icing on it, frosting, you'll get a burst that will result in a spike of blood sugar and the kind of reformation that they're talking about in this article. So there's a difference between dates break down because they're a solid mass. They're not as refined. So the bottom line is that, inshallah ta'ala, as we'll read, is that in general, unless you eat piece after piece after piece, you don't have to worry about the sweetness or the sugar found in fruits. But refined sugars of all kinds, meaning the sugar that you put on things, or that are found in other things, cookies, cakes, and all of this other stuff, are not a good bet for health. They should be avoided. Eat fruits instead. Eat dates, but two nights a week, three nights a week, or some limited number, not meal after meal and time after time, for example. The Sahaba, what did they eat? Seven dates was considered a meal. Not, you know, piling on, and they were hungry also. Nasrullah tawfiq wa taysir. And so fruit juices are a bad bet because they're high in calorie. They're calorie-dense food. It takes several oranges to make a glass of fruit juice. They're not, and as we will read, inshallah ta'ala, fruit juices are one of the main ways of putting on calories, and let alone soft drinks. The soft drinks have a huge release and these other things. The body is satiety. When you eat processed foods so much that they become hyperpalatable, super tasty, it thwarts the body's ability to regulate. It's like coca leaves and cocaine, he suggests. When you get the coca leaf in nature, it's mildly reinforcing, but people don't overuse it. But when you process the coca leaf into cocaine, all hell breaks loose. It overrides good judgment, wisdom, and responsibility. Browning says that you can make the same argument for these hyperpalatable foods. The body just doesn't know how to handle them. Clearly, research on food and addiction is just gathering steam. We need studies that follow people over time. What exists now are snapshots in time. But if the early clues pan out, people will look more carefully at how much and how often they, quote, indulge. The take-home message is that frequent consumption of calorie-dense food may be altering your brain responses in a way that's going to make you consume more. So, bottom line is that, one, research on brain and food addiction is in its infancy, but studies suggest that overeating may dampen your dopamine response. This weak response makes you overeat even more. You may be more likely to overeat foods that are calorie dense, fatty, or sweet. Three, stress and dieting can lead to overeating. Nasrullah tawfiq. What to do? Avoid mindless eating. Two, eat at mealtimes and eat as much as you need. Beware of cues, smells, and looks, and so forth. Avoid the troublemakers. Many people know which foods make them lose control. And avoid them. Eat healthy foods, eating a lot of fish and vegetables and fruits occasionally, and avoiding the high, sweet things. Distract yourselves. It doesn't matter if I get, but this behavior modification people say that it does matter. You have to practice breaking the automatic response by enjoying something else. Beware of stress. Don't eat when you're stressed, and in order to alleviate your stress, and exercise. In rats, running on a treadmill can increase dopamine receptors. And so exercise undoes the problem. And sedentary people in their 70s and 80s, the aerobic exercise program increased the volume of the brain's cortex. Right? Increased the brain's volume. And so it had. We now have brilliant data that shows that an increase in prefrontal cortex nerve cells. That's extremely important because this is where you have the executive function and rein on impulses that they've characterized as the brake in this other article. And guess what? It doesn't have to be extreme activity. Risk walking can be enough. And so this is yet another benefit of fitness and an angle for fitness and suluk. Inshallah ta'ala will read something more if Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala keeps us alive for another round of storytelling next week. Nasallahu tawfiq wa taysir. I have a lot of questions here. What type of exercise? Someone emailed the following question to address very shortly. Someone please ask Sheikh Noor, what type of exercise he recommends for housewives that can't attend a local gym or for specific reasons can't leave the house to take a walk? Go for a walk with your husband if you can, but otherwise get the XBX program and do it. If you can do it twice a day, all the better. Or jump rope for 15 minutes a day. You know, be aggressive, put the kids to bed, and take time out to exercise a bit. And it's Allah tawfiq wa taysir. The XBX for women, the 5BX program for men. The XBX program takes 11 minutes, and the 5BX, I believe, takes 9 minutes or something like that. So these are both doable, and they take a relatively small amount of time. They're graduated in difficulty and effort. And nasallahu alaihi wa sallam. What's that? I'll endeavor to finish the articles. Excuse me for going on and on about the topic, but I think it's interesting. I mean, it's something that nobody knows about, and everybody knows somebody who's affected. And so inshallah, we'll continue our storytelling next Sunday. Fatiha.